Coffee in Space is a podcast by S. Daniel Smith that puts the best in established and up-and-coming science fiction and fantasy writers in front of you, their readers. Dan's goal is to help you learn more about who they are as people, how they write, and how they live. Whether you're listening to this podcast at home, or in your car, or somewhere in between, Dan hopes to transport you to the crew lounge on an intergalactic spaceship, where you can have a cup of your favourite coffee with science fiction and fantasy authors. So sit back, listen in, and enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, this is Dan Smith. I'm a big science fiction fan and a heavy coffee drinker. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 26 of Coffee in Space. I've got award-winning short fiction writer Erin Roberts in the studio today to talk about her work, world building, and the value of short fiction. Erin, it's great to have you in the studio today. Thanks for having Coffee in Space with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Folks, I first learned about Erin by working on my own craft. One podcast I listen to almost every week to better my writing is called Writing Excuses. If you search for it, you'll find it. It's a very popular podcast. I personally can't recommend it enough, by the way. Anyway, Erin has been a guest a few times on Writing Excuses, and she's graciously agreed to be a guest on Coffee in Space as well. If you go to Writing Excuses, you can hear Erin talk and teach about writing on Season 15, Episodes 12 and 35. And I think there might be another one in there too. I'll track it down and put it in the show notes. Okay, I'll stop blathering on and get to the interview. Erin, tell us a little bit about yourself, your training, your writing.
All right. I'm Erin, as you know, and I am a relatively new, I still like to think, writer in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. I started writing, decided to get into genre writing in 2014 and took a class at the Gotham Writers Center in New York City. And it was an amazing class, great teacher. Some of my classmates are still friends of mine. And, you know, during the class, I was like, I really like this. I've always been a storyteller and just like in the way that I live my life. But maybe this is something where I want to get published and I want to actually, you know, try to do this as part of my profession. And so I decided to kind of jump into learning with all the way in, plunge into the kind of deep end of the pool. So I went to the Odyssey Writing Workshop the following summer, and then I went and got an MFA in creative writing and just graduated from there in 2018. So in the middle of all that, I published some short stories mostly. Most of my work is short fiction, and I've been sort of pleased and lucky to have work published in Asimov's, in Clark's World, The Dark, Podcastle, and I've even done some interactive fiction in Sub-Q. So that's me.
Yeah, and I'll put a lot of that in the show notes. So if you're listening to this in your vehicle, go look it up on the Buzzsprout website. Or if you're in the Facebook group, just click on the full link and you'll get the examples. I checked out a couple of your short stories, Erin, that you have links to. The Clark's World especially has a link that goes directly to the story. So it's not hidden behind any kind of, paywall or whatever. So you can get a taste of Erin's writing that way. What themes, Erin, are important to you as you write? Do you have an overarching theme that kind of defines you, or do you let each story tell the theme? How does that work for you?
You know, I think that as writers, we're all influenced by sort of who we are and the things that we're thinking about. So even if you're not thinking, oh, I have a theme to my work, when I go back and look at my work, I can say, oh, okay, I can see some similarities in these stories, even though it seemed to me at the time that they were just random ideas that came to me. You know, there are some themes there in the work. And I would say that the primary ones that I see, especially in my published work, are the idea of kind of more oppressive cultures, or cultures that have really strict rules or oppressive rules, and what that does to the people within them, and how living in kind of an oppressive or stagnant culture can actually change the way that you see the world and the way that you react to it and who you are as a person.
Yeah, I like that. So let me follow up with, You know, everyone's got kind of their view of what the future looks like. I think we all hope that the future will be better, especially considering, you know, kind of the time period that you and I are recording this episode in. And, you know, I don't see things getting fixed in the next few weeks before the episode airs, unfortunately.
That'd be great.
Yeah, it'd be great. But I don't see it happening, unfortunately. How does the, you know, the oppressive cultures and things that you write about with a future perspective play on what you might actually hope that the future looks like?
Actually, this is an amazing question, because as much as I see those themes in my work, I've been challenging those themes a little bit recently. You know, I've been thinking, do I really want to be kind of living in these oppressive cultures? And a lot of, I think what my work sort of says is that, you know, the oppressive culture turns the people within it into monsters in their own way. Like, if you live in a monstrous world, it's hard not to become a monster yourself, even if you're well-meaning and even if you don't want to be. And so, but in my sort of day job and in my regular life, I work in a social justice-focused nonprofit. We've been spending a lot of time talking about kind of regenerative models, the idea that people come together, and instead of individually fighting against oppression, which can corrupt you, people can come together and form like better, more interesting, more collaborative models. You know, where I was just reading about, there's this series of fridges that have popped up in Philly where people who are restaurant owners who can't have their restaurants open during COVID and had extra food put out free refrigerators that were there for anyone in the community who didn't have food. So stuff like that, where it's like people helping each other and really coming together. And so that's what I hope to see more of in the future. And I think my writing may, we'll see, start reflecting some of those ideas more going forward.
Yeah, I can see how that would be hard to do as a writer, because you want to reflect the things that are happening in society now. That's the thing that fantasy and science fiction gives us in a general theme, I think. But you also want to, you don't want to lose what you do actually hope happens, I suppose. Anyway, I could go off on that one a little bit. So I'll try and rein myself in. This is Aaron. This is why I use a script. The first time I heard you on Writing Excuses, you were talking about writing the other and being an ally. Now, Coffee and Space isn't a craft development podcast per se, but we do have several aspiring and current authors who subscribe to the show. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is meant by writing the other? You can even talk about being an ally if you want, but writing the other, and give us a couple of ideas of how we should do it if we are aspiring writers.
Sure. The first thing I'll say is that I am definitely not the expert on writing the other, but I know who is. If you Google writing the other, there's actually a book about it, and there are a series of classes that are actually held to help you if you're interested in building your craft in that way. But to give you sort of the baseline information, writing the other is basically writing people who come from cultures that are not your own, basically. So they are from another culture or another background or have another sort of identity that is different than yours. And the first thing people often say when they hear that concept is, well, everyone I write is not me. I'm not writing just like carbon copies of myself. That's boring. And that is true. But what it's more meant by is that when you go to write, especially a group of people who maybe have had their stories marginalized, only told one way, not told at all in the past, you really want to be careful about the way that you're writing them so that you're not feeding into stereotypes or, you know, going down well-worn, kind of tired, tropey paths. And so you want to make sure that you're doing it in a well-researched and a well-thought-out way. And so some of the tips that I would give if you are interested in writing the other, or writing especially from groups that you're not familiar with or groups that are marginalized, is number one, go to writing the other and take their classes. But number two is to try not to fall prey to something I think a lot of us do, which is to think that our own choices are driven by individual free will. I mean, they are, but like everything I do is just because of who I am, but everything someone from another group or a background or situation I'm unfamiliar with does is because of that situation or culture or background. You know, so I think one of the things I always like to tell people is before you write the other, make sure you can write the self. Before you go write about a foreign land, like, can you even describe your own hometown?
Mm, that makes sense.
You know what I mean? You want to put that same depth, and you want to have like kind of the same type of writing for both. You don't want to make, you know, you don't want to like go into the deep history. Like, I'm sure all y'all who are readers, it's like when you're reading a book and they go like really deep into some technology and you're like, no one would think this way. Like when I pick up the phone, I don't think about like the history of the telephone and like why it was invented. Like I think about, I need to make a call. And I think a lot of times that over explanation can make it seem when you're doing work about writing who a person is and their identity, can make it seem as if other people are driven more by their group than who they are as people, which is not the best way to kind of think about others. So that's sort of a quick tip for sort of how to think about it. Do your own, write something close to you first, work on your craft there where you have the knowledge, and then see how you can apply that craft to something that's a little less familiar.
Do you think, and I know I'm asking you to speculate a lot here, but do you think that we as writers sometimes over-explain something when writing about a different culture or society or a different people group to almost try and prove to whoever might be reading it that either we know what we're talking about, or it's kind of like that, you know, I have a black friend, so I'm not racist type deal, you know, type thing. Do you think we do it that way, or is it just over-explanation? Am I reading too much into it?
No, I think there could be a lot of reasons, but one of them is this kind of, I did the research. Like I know what I'm talking about, but I think the danger there is that sometimes you're sprinkling in a lot of surface level details and not really thinking about what's deeper in identity and culture and kind of world building. You know, it's, people do the things they do and cultures develop the way they develop because of their beliefs and the things that they hold to be true. Like American culture is really big into individualism. You know, that doesn't mean that every day you say like a specific ritual about individualism. It just means that it would influence the way you see other things. Or I know that you have a lot of folks listening who are in the military. If I were to write about the military and just threw in a bunch of jargon without really understanding what it's like to be in the military, then I think like it's like you did the research, but you did the Wikipedia level research. You didn't go deeper. And I think
you didn't understand. Really, you didn't really like, you didn't do the work. You just
exactly.
You just took the easy way. Yeah, I get you. I understand
and,
that.
The only other thing I'll say is, unfortunately, when it comes to things having to do with culture and identity, gender, disability, when someone questions you and says, hey, you didn't do the work, if they're talking about like your portrayal of horseback riding, you'd be like, oh yeah, maybe I need to do better. But I think sometimes if you say you didn't do the work about writing about my culture, people think you're saying like, you are a bad person and you are like insensitive, and so they get like really defensive and they don't listen to what the person is saying, which is that there's more you could be doing with your craft. It has nothing to do with who you are, just how you're writing this particular story.
Well, if anyone can take something personal from a rejection, it's a writer. Or at least I know I have. So okay, so now let's switch hats right quick from writer to reader. If I'm reading a book, how do I know if I'm reading well done work as far as writing the other is concerned, or, you know, someone who's truly trying to be an ally? How do I know if I'm reading the good stuff or if I'm reading, as you called it, the Wikipedia level research?
You know, I would say it's difficult to do on your own as a reader sometimes, because if you don't know any more than, like, if you don't know about that group either, then it's easy to get kind of, how would you know to question further?
Sure.
That's why I'm a huge fan of learning from reading a lot of different reviewers and a lot of different people's opinions about what you're reading. Some folks hate reviews and never like to read them, but I really think it's fun to read a lot of different people's analysis of a work and their response to it, because the more people you read and the more interpretations you see of a work, I think it deepens your own reading and understanding of that work. And especially if it's one where you're like, I'm not sure if that was really, is that really like the way, you know, people are, you know, is this really the way I think this should be done? Or was this done, you know, from a really great, well-researched, well-done writing perspective, is to read reviews and responses from folks who are in the group that's being portrayed and see if they're resonating or if there's like some sort of, a lot of times people will say very vocally, hey, like, this is not right. You did this and that, and it wasn't great. And it made me feel this kind of way. So
that's really great. So that reminds me, I've been meaning to put out to the listeners my Goodreads handle or whatever they're calling it. I like the idea of reading. I mean, I read reviews. I've got a TBR, a to-be-read pile that's like, you know, tall enough to topple a skyscraper. So, you know, I have to be able to read reviews that tell me if a book is worth reading or not. So I think that's a good point to you know, to also be reading it to find out if the culture that's being written about is well researched and well done. I like that very much.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, no culture is a monolith. So you can have things where some folks will say, this was a great portrayal, and others will say, this was horrible. But a lot of times, if something is particularly problematic, you'll see like a fairly good consensus about that. And so you can say, like that's seems like everyone mostly agrees that this it has some issues. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't read it, even as a reader. It just means that you should read it critically, because when we read, we take in a little bit about the world. And the downside of reading poor representation is that that poor representation can become your understanding of other people, especially if you don't have anything, like, you're not ever seeing folks from this group in your own life. Like, you don't want everything that you're learning to come from television and books, if that television and books is not particularly deep, or if it relies on like harmful stereotypes.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably really applicable if we read the classics of science fiction and fantasy that maybe were written first in a different time period, but also with a different cultural understanding.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's something to keep in mind too. Okay, so I'd like to pivot to another area that you're passionate about, sure. World building, which you've also been on the show writing excuses to talk about. So can you take a few minutes to explain your process for world building and why it's important to why it's important for an aspiring author to take note of?
Sure. So I tend to think of coming up with stories as like a, almost like a little tripod. And one leg of the tripod is like the character who's in the story, who is the story about? And one leg is, where are they? What's the world that they're in? And one leg is kind of what's happening. What's the plot? And I think you can always start from any one of the legs of the tripod and then build the other two. And so some of my stories start with a character, some start with a concept, some start with a world. But no matter what they are, usually they start very flimsily, isn't the right word, but I'm a big fan of my world starting with like a one line idea. So yeah. For example, in the story that you mentioned earlier, Sour Milk Girls in Clark's World, that story starts with, I love the idea of like memory being a commodity. What if memory was something you could buy or sell or steal or trade? And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Now what? And so once I had the idea, usually my next goal is to go to the next leg of the tripod. So some people will build a whole world out before they go into a character or anything else. Usually when I have a world, I'm like, well, who would benefit from this world and who would not benefit? And I love the characters who are basically suffering or in some way like facing, you know, some sort of challenge because of the world. For one thing, nobody likes to read about characters who are like, my life is great. The world is amazing.
Yeah that's
you
true.
You want to have some sort of struggle. But also I'm really interested in the underdog, in folks who are marginalized. And so I'm interested in my concept to think, all right, well, if you're selling memories, like, does everyone have access? Like, who's selling them? Like, who's buying them? Like, what, you know, who doesn't have access? And so then I'll come up with like a character without out of the world and then go to the plot. And then what happens is, as I start writing, so then I'll just, I'm a pantser. So I don't do all the planning beforehand. I'll start writing. And oftentimes as I'm writing, I'll like throw in a word. Like I'll be like, oh, I'm writing this sentence. Wouldn't it be cool if there was like a machine that you could carry that, I don't know, took memories from you? Great. And then I'll say, okay, now I have that in my world. And I actually keep a PowerPoint document where I take things that I've written into the pantsing that I'm like, oh, I like that concept, and put them all in one sheet. So then I can look later and be like, well, does this make sense? Like, would a world that has A and B also have C and B? Or like, is that too much? And so I kind of build it as I'm writing, and then go back as I'm like, when I get stuck in the plot, which often happens, I'll go back and then look at the world and say, well, here are the details I have. Let's try to like build out more of what that world would look like. Maybe that'll give me more ideas about the character or more ideas about the plot. So it's sort of very organic.
I like that. It's good for you to explain how a pantser or someone who doesn't work off of an outline, how that might, the world building might come about in your system. Cause I know there are a lot of people, I'm one of them. Outlines kind of throw me off, to be honest. I feel kind of caged in. I'm not a person who can work from them. So that's actually really cool. So do you ever find yourself having to essentially rebuild the world? Like, do you ever throw a concept in your sentence or something? And then as you're doing the math on if they had A and B, would they get C and D? You find out that doesn't work. Do you go back through it and try and kind of make it work? Or do you just screw up the last thing you did since it doesn't fit anymore? How does that work for you?
A lot of times I'll take it out if it wasn't, actually what I'll do is evaluate it. So I'll be like, what do I care? What is the thing that is drawing is most interesting to me? And what also makes the most sense for this plot? So if it was this really cool thing that I came up with, but it like doesn't really advance the plot, I just thought it was cool, and it like completely throws off everything else I'm doing, then I'll put that in like a file of like cool things to use in a different story that's in a different world that like doesn't have these issues. And you know, I'll just change it later. And a lot of times in one of the things that I would find that I find in a pantsing life is that when you get to the end of the story, I often reverse outline. So I'll go back and be like, well, what did I just write? What's in here? Like, I wrote a first draft. There's a bunch of stuff. And so some of the revising process is actually going through and seeing like, okay, what actually works here? And if it doesn't work, then I'll take it out, the sort of kill your darlings idea of fiction, and put it to the side for something else. And one of the great things about short fiction, which I know we're going to talk about a little later, is that short fiction is just a moment. So you don't have to have as much world as you do in a novel, you know, because you're only talking about a small kind of important moment in a character's life or in the life of the world. And so a lot of times if something doesn't work, I might say, maybe there's a different story where I can explore that further or figure out how that would connect back. But in this small moment, it's not necessary. And because I have other short stories I can write, I don't feel so badly about kind of shoving it to the side.
No, I like that a lot. In fact, you just helped me apply something. I have an entire section of a story I had to rip out because it didn't make sense anymore. And the fact that, you know, you can build another moment, another story out of it sometime. So you not recycle, you're actually repurposing. You repurpose concepts and ideas from a story that didn't work and put it in another one, huh?
Yeah. And sometimes I'll have things that share a world. So the same world that exists in Sour Milk Girls, I did an interactive fiction piece called Thanks for the Memories, which takes place in that same world, but at a different time with a different character. And just like random fun fact, two of my published stories are actually things I wrote to better understand either the world or a character. Like I was like, oh, I want to write this whole thing about this character Ghost. I really want to like, but I'm just having trouble understanding her. So I was like, why don't I go back and just as a writing exercise, write something from earlier in her life that might give me a sense of where she comes from as a character, and sort of intended as a writing exercise, and then actually grew into a story of its own. And so I think similarly, I sometimes will say like, oh, this is a really interesting plot thing. Like maybe I'll just take that out and explore it in a different story and give it bigger life there.
So which story was that then? So the primary was Sour Milk Girls that was in Clark's world. What was the one you just talked about?
So the one that I've talked about is actually a much longer novel that I'm working on.
Oh,
so,
okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it's actually that's how I'm a naturally short writer. So novels are harder for me. And so of course, in the course of working on a novel, I'm like, oh, I'll just spin off short stories that like help me better understand the characters in the world.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. I feel you on the, I'm a short story writer. I, I kind of run out of steam after a while, and it's easier to look into a 6,000 to 10,000 word story as opposed to, anyway, I'm getting off on the side again. So you already kind of made the segue for me. Let's go on and do it. One more thing to talk about is long-time listeners know I recently did an episode, a solo episode that talked about the value of short fiction. In fact, I challenged the listeners to go and buy an issue of a science fiction fantasy magazine or even mystery, if that's your thing, and give it a go. So as a prolific short fiction author, Aaron, tell us a little bit about the value of short fiction from a reader's perspective.
Sure. I would say from a reader's perspective, short fiction is fast to read. Like, you can kind of get in and get out. And if you, you know, when you're doing a novel, like, that's a little bit of an investment. And short fiction is a great way to kind of get in, see a little bit of the world, and then get out and still get that great story experience. I also think that people in short fiction sometimes do a little more experimentation than on a novel level. And the reason is, when you write a novel, though you can always self-publish, if you go with traditional publishing, you've got to convince someone that a bunch of people are going to want to read this book. And even if you're self-publishing, you need to believe that a lot of people are going to want to read this book. Otherwise, you know, you just save it for your friends and family. And so there's a little bit of like marketing or figuring out what people will like that I think, even if you don't want it to be, can come in when you're thinking about novels. But in short fiction, what the short fiction magazines are publishing, they do their own marketing, saying like, we just publish a lot of great short fiction. And so a lot of times you can try really interesting things and do things that are a little more experimental, or like, you know, if you ever read a story that's in the second person where it's you instead of I or he or she, like, that usually is going to be a shorter piece because it's hard for people to live with that for an entire book.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a really fun way to try like a new genre, a new type of writing that you don't know that you'll like. You don't know you like science fiction? Try a science fiction story, try a couple. And then if it turns out that something in there you really like, you can also go and ask people, oh, turns out I just really love generation ships. Like, that's the only kind of science fiction story that's doing it for me. Like, what do you think I should read novel wise? And then they can tell you, oh, if you love a generation ship, you know, read this. So I think it's a great way to identify what you like, the same way that like listening to the radio, like if you listen to a radio station that plays a little bit of everything, you can get a sense of what kind of music you might like. If you read a bunch of short fiction, you can get a sense of what you like within the broader genres of science fiction, fantasy, etc.
That is a fascinating way to put that. Of course, we, you know, Pandora or whatever, whatever the kids are using nowadays. I still listen to the radio, but you wouldn't just expect to only listen to a couple of artists. You want to find out more about it and the wider musical world. And of course, that's the same thing for short fiction. By the way, Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson is the answer to your question about generation ships, at least from my perspective. Okay, so Aaron, as you know, I ask guest authors to read a little from one of their works. I hope you've narrowed it down. Which one are you going to pick for us today?
I have. Since we've talked about it, I'm going to read the beginning of Sour Milk Girls.
That's wonderful.
And I will go with, I got about 2 to 3 minutes, right? So I will.
That's what I, that's, know. I mean, yeah, let's go with that.
Wave at me when it's time for me to stop, and I will wrap around there.
All sounds right. Good.
The new girl showed up to the agency on a Sunday, looking like an old dish rag and smelling like sour milk. Not that I could really smell her from 3 floors up through the mesh and bars, but there's only 3 types of girls here, and she was definitely the sour milk kind. Her head hung down like it was too much work to raise it, and her long black hair flopped around so you couldn't see her face. I'd have bet a week's credits she had old scaredy cat eyes, but she never bothered to look up. Just let Miss Miranda lead her by the elbow through the front doors. Didn't even try to run. Sour milk all the way. Even sour milk new girls were good, though. Anything new was good. The last one, Hope, might have been dull as old paint, but at least she'd been something different to talk about. I'd even won a day's credits from Flash by betting the girl wouldn't make it to 14 without some foster trying her out and keeping her. anyone could tell Hope smelled like cinnamon and honey, same as those babies on the first floor and the second floor girls with their pigtails and missing tooth smiles. Sure enough, only took 6 months before the Reynolds came and took Hope off to their nice house with the big beds and the white fence and those stupid yapping dogs, leaving just me and Whispers and Flash to stare at each other and count all the months and years till we turn 18. Flash should have known it would go that way. Cinnamon and honey is something Fosters can't resist. Whispers said this new girl was officially called Brenda, but that was just as stupid as all the other agency names, and the girl wouldn't remember it after processing anyway. At first I said we should call her Dish Rag or Milk Breath, but even Flash thought that was too mean, and Flash is as nasty as hot sauce and lye. She's the one who named me Ghost, on account of I'm small and shadow dark, and she thinks I creep around too much in the night. She got her name, because that's how fast Fosters send her back after their cat turns up dead, and they realize the devil has blonde hair and dimples.
That's great. Hearing it in your voice, I can really kind of gather more than even the surface reading I was able to do earlier. So I love the story. Y'all, I'll put it in the show notes so you can go get to it. And of course, it'll be on your website, or it is on your website as well. So, Aaron, thanks so much for your time today. I really enjoyed the chat. In the final few minutes we have, tell people how we can find out more about you and your work.
Sure. Probably one of the best places to find me is on Twitter, if you are a Twitterer. I'm at Nirelle, and it's N-I-R-E-L-E. Fun fact, that is L. Aaron backwards, not on purpose, but it is. And you can, my website is writingwonder.com, from ye old sense of wonder that they always talk about in speculative fiction. So writingwonder.com, and you can find all my stuff there, and including places that I will be next. And I will obviously put a link to this awesome show once it's out and about. So thank you so much for having me.
It's been great. So you are going to be doing some teaching coming up. Is that true?
Yes, I'm going to be. You mentioned that I've been on the Writing Excuses podcast, and a bunch of us who have been or who are instructors there are going to be teaching at the Surrey International Writing Conference in late October. So it's around like October 26th. I'll be doing a class on writing culture. I'll be doing a class on decolonizing fiction, which is about sort of finding new ways to tell stories that don't deal with kind of harmful old tropes like colonizing space or all elves are this way. And I'll also be talking about actually how to make it as a freelancer and get money as a writer, like how to get grants and gigs and things like that. So I have all that information on my website and upcoming appearances. So if you go there, you'll be able to check it out.
Awesome. Thank you. I'll definitely, and I'll point to it in the show notes too. Well, thanks for being my guest today, Aaron. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you all for listening to this episode. Take a look at Aaron's work and her website, and check her out on Twitter. Be sure to subscribe to Coffee in Space podcast. I'm Dan Smith, and I can't wait to meet again over a cup of coffee in space.